Stephen Sondheim is considered the greatest Broadway composer, lyricist of our time, and one of the best and most musically innovative ever. Sondheim got a start on Broadway as the lyricist for West Side Story and Gypsy. Then he went on to write words and music for such shows as Anyone Can Whistle, Company, Follies, A Little Night Music, Sweeney Todd, Sunday in the Park with George, Into the Woods, Assassins, and Roadshow. After his acclaimed and best-selling Finishing the Hat, named one of the New York Times' 10 best books of 2010, Sondheim returns with the second volume of his collected lyrics, Look, I Made a Hat, giving us another glimpse into the mind of this living legend and his life's work. Picking up where he left off in Finishing the Hat, Sondheim gives us all the lyrics, along with the excluded songs and early drafts of the Pulitzer Prize-winning Sunday in the Park with George, Into the Woods, Assassins, and Passion. Here, too, is an in-depth look at the evolution of Wise Guys, which subsequently was transformed into Bounce and eventually became Roadshow. Stephen Sondheim, what a thrill to have you as a guest on the program. I thank you very much for being with us.
Delighted to be here.
You know, I mentioned the part of the book of the look of the evolution of Wise Guys, and it brought to my mind of how I read the first book, Finishing the Hat, which as I kind of hopscotched around to various things that I was interested in. And in this book is much more linear. You want to read it from start to finish as opposed to hopscotching around because of that evolution that you portray in the book.
Yeah, that section, which is four chapters, should be read in order because it is indeed an evolution. It's, as they're too fond of saying in the theater these days, a journey. And anybody who wants to know how musicals can go off the rails, on the rails, off the rails, on the rails, and finally end up in the station they're supposed to, because it did, this is an exemplary chapter or set of chapters.
What does that evolution mean to you in the sense of when you look back at that time, was the end product worth that, again, the word, journey?
Oh, sure, absolutely. No, I think the show's terrific, and so does John Wyman, who wrote it with me. And no, I think we're delighted. I think we wish it had taken not so much less time, but fewer divagations. I think we wish that we had sort of latched on to what we were missing and what we were overstating when we began. But that is always true of anything. That's true of a song. That's true of... You always waste time, so to speak, with mistakes, but of course you're not really wasting time. You're exploring things that turn out to be useless or only pointing their way to something else. And so you have to go through it. You go through that, just as I say, writing a song, writing a play, painting a painting, whatever. But in the case of Wise Guys, it just took too many times at bat, I think. I don't know that we could have shortcut any of it. We learned something from every version of it and every incarnation, and so perhaps it was all necessary. But it certainly took a lot longer than any other show I've been connected with.
You are the best thing that ever has happened to me. You are. Okay then, one of the best things that's happened to me. You are. They say we all find love. I never bought it.
You talk in the beginning of the new book about how, after the first book came out, you got a lot of suggestions from friends about different things and how you processed that. So in some way, that did have an impact on how you approached the second half of the story. You made the conscious decision to do this in two volumes, and when you
I made a conscious decision to do it in one volume, but I just knew it was going to turn out to be too long and too heavy, and meaning literally in its weight, and therefore suggested the publisher to do it in two volumes. But I didn't write it in two volumes; I wrote it essentially as one. I always thought of it as one volume, just a chronological survey and with commentaries along the way. So the two-volume thing is a matter of practicality, not a matter of creative design.
Between the first volume and the second, did you get input from friends that said to you, that commented about the work that you had put forth in the first
volume? No, very little. What I essentially got were, you omitted this lyric, how about the version that was in London, et cetera, et cetera. Because I have a couple of close friends who read it as I wrote it, and so whatever input I cared to get, I got from them as I was writing. And then the only other comment, really, but I expected it from not so much from a lot of friends, but a couple of people said, "Gee, I wish you'd written about music more." And I explained in the introduction to this book that the music is very hard to write about unless you're writing to musicians, because a lot of it is jargon, and a lot of it has to do with the specifics that have to do with techniques of writing music and the whole language of Western music and everything from diatonic scales to, you know, added sixths. So, you know, I just consciously determined not to write about music. I touch on music only lightly, because otherwise an average reader wouldn't understand what you were talking about.
Right. When you talk about people saying, oh, you know, perhaps omitted this or omitted that, I mean, you can nitpick that stuff to death, can't you?
Well, there were nits that were worth picking. But as I say, they had to do with either mistaken attributions or omissions, things like that. Nobody picked nits, you know, saying, I don't agree with you about this or that.
No.
There's no point. I mean, obviously, whatever I have to say that is opinionated. So there's no point in. But picking a nit and saying, you know, that song did not come from that show, that's another matter. Because I would like it to be factually accurate.
When you took on this project initially, what was the hope? Because you make very clear in this book, there will never be an autobiography. So in taking on a project like that, what is the mission?
Oh, it's for anybody who's interested in the techniques of, it's essentially teaching. It's the techniques of writing songs for the theater and writing theatrical pieces, musical pieces. I wanted to give anybody who's interested in that the advantage of what I've been through, just the way Oscar Hammerstein, you know, taught me through the eyes of somebody who'd done what he had done. You know, I find it always fascinating to read anything about any profession written by somebody who's passionate about his profession, and the more detail he goes into, the more I like it.
But children will listen. Children will look to you. For which way to turn to learn what to be? Careful before you say, listen to me. Children will listen. Careful the wish you make. Wishes are children. Careful the path they take. Wishes come true, not free.
You talk about Oscar Hammerstein and that connection. Is it still telling to you of what you learned from him? I mean, I assume that when you look back, and even in the process of writing this, that there are things that you can make a direct lineation to him and something that it was either said or something that you just picked up. I assume that still comes to you of things that you've learned that may not have been conscious at the time, but now and through this process and looking at the lyrics and putting together a collection over this over a number of years, how great the influence was.
No, I think I had pretty well codified it before I'd sat down to write this thing. You know, I've talked about what Oscar taught me so many times in public and with friends and with other songwriters that, you know, there wasn't much left to discover, if anything. You know, perhaps I discovered, as I started to analyze some of his lyrics in print, some things I felt about his work that I might not have articulated as much before, but nothing really new in the way of a thought or a take on his work or what he taught me, no. I'd pretty well digested all that stuff over a long period of time.
One of my favorite quotes from you is you say that familiarity breeds content.
Well, that's true. I was talking specifically about people who say who talk about hummable tunes.
Right.
And, you know, and the more you hear any tune, the more it lodges in your consciousness and becomes what one might call tuneful, meaning memorable, which is what people really mean. I like to give as an example the Berg Violin Concerto, which the first time I heard it, I thought, what is all that noise? And the fifth time I heard it, I thought, my goodness, how beautiful.
For people, when they leave the theater, do you care about that hummability?
No, not at all. First of all, I might have if I'd been born a generation earlier, because the generation before me, hit tunes came from Broadway shows and movies. And so there was a sort of double need to not only satisfy the theater audience, but to satisfy a listening audience on radio, you know, such things as the hit parade. And not so much a question of making money, but of the audience you're writing for, so to speak. In the 1950s, as soon as the singer-songwriter came into prominence and bands were formed that wrote their own songs, and television helped to, you know, lessen the impact of theaters, and then rock concerts, the impact of theatrical music. Curious enough, it freed everybody to write much more free-form songs than they had before, because you didn't have to satisfy the hit parade mentality or reception. So hummability no longer matters in the theater. What matters in the theater is the dramatic impact or theatrical impact of the songs. Nobody expects a hit song to come out of a show, and there hasn't been any hit songs come out of a show in a very, very long time.
The sun comes up, I think about you. The coffee cup, I think about you. I want you so. It's like I'm losing my mind. The morning ends, I think about you. I talk to friends, I think about you. And do they know? It's like I'm losing my mind. All afternoon doing every little chore, the thought of you stays bright. Sometimes I stand in the middle of the floor, not going left, not going right.
When you see a show get a revival like Follies, which is on Broadway now, the cast album is just out, how do you look at that? Is it a new project, or is it again an extension of work that you have done before? How do you view it?
I don't think of it as either. It's a revisit. It's, you know, it's like going back to a foreign city you once went to. It's or greeting an old friend that you haven't seen in a long time. It's not so much looking back, but looking again. And certain works of art, both commercial and non-commercial, are worth looking at or listening to more than once, and certain are not. And it's one way to find out.
Obviously, you have been doing a lot of work with this book, but with Follies up, you still go to the theater quite a bit to see it.
Oh, sure. Well, somebody has to check it. In this case, the director, who lives in Washington, so it's usually the director's chore primarily, although every author goes in to revisit a show while it's running, just to see that a certain, I won't call them standards, but aspects of the performances, both on the stage and in the orchestra pit, maintain a freshness and energy that they had, let's say, on opening night. Because sometimes, you know, after a show's been running, particularly if it's a long-running show, there's a tiredness sets in and the cast starts to either perform by rote or oversell, because as the audiences, the first few months of audiences are usually what we would call theatrical sophisticates, people who go to the theater a lot, probably live in the tri-state area, if not in New York City itself. But the long-running strength of a show depends on audiences from out of town, and they are often slower in reaction to whatever is going on the stage, or at least different in reaction, and the cast starts to sometimes oversell. They think that the audience is bored because it isn't applauding as loudly or as frequently as it might have in the first couple of months, particularly if it's a, quote, sophisticated show, as opposed to a spectacle or something with a great deal of loud and energetic music, particularly if it's trying to tell a story. So you have to check on things like that to be sure that the performance is not going over the top, to be sure that the balance in the orchestra is right. Also, during the course of a run, musicians are replaced by other musicians in the pit, and so the band sometimes loses its tensile strength, etc. You know, things get sloppy, you know, which is a natural process. After all, 8 performances a week, you know, particularly performers can easily get bored with what they're doing because they're doing it over and over again, particularly if the roles they're playing aren't large or notable or have real moments. And that boredom conveys itself in a loss of energy and crispness. And again, it's a natural process. But if somebody comes in and galvanizes them because they're professionals, it changes things.
In viewing that and watching the show, where do you like to be to see that in the theater?
Well, I generally like to be in the back. That's partly because if there are any theater buffs in the audience and they see me, they're looking at me as much as the show to see what my reaction is. So that's a matter of, again, practicality. But most theaters have, the back rows of most theaters, certainly the ones that my shows have been in, are sometimes acoustically superior to down front. And most of them have excellent sight lines so that one can see what the action is on the stage. Sometimes if the orchestra, that is to say the lower floor, they used to call the parquet, or what they call the stalls in England. If it's very large, in the larger theater, sometimes the back row diminishes the view of the stage enough so that it affects you, in which case I usually try to get seats, you know, like 10 rows down or something like that. But most theaters have excellent views from the back row and sometimes, as I say, superior acoustics.
What is it about a performer, of someone like, and I was just listening to the cast album, so she stands out, but what is there, somebody like Bernadette Peters, who's so recognized through much of your work, and I would assume for you is a joy to collaborate with?
Well, sure she is. If your question is she a joy to collaborate with, the answer is a resounding yes. I've been very lucky with the people I've worked with, because like Bernadette, Angela Lansbury, Patti LuPone, these are people who act and sing with equal skill. And for anybody who writes the kind of shows I do, that's not only a necessity, it's a joy. So it sounds like I'm just picking the women, but there's also people like Mandy Patinkin and John McMartin. Mm-hmm. As I say, I should say fortunate enough, but it's partly because my collaborators and I have good taste, and we know the better performers, and if they're available and they want to do the part, that's, you know, everybody benefits. Yeah, it's always a pleasure to work with professionals, always.
How do you look at the current production of Follies? Is it something that you're enjoying the process?
Oh, yes. I like it. I like it very much. I like it. It's a hard show to put on, and I think that the director, Eric Schaefer, and certainly the cast have done a really superior job, and you know, it's a legendary show because of its first production, which was so spectacular. And so a lot of people who have either heard about the show and never had a chance to see it come in and with high anticipation. And I think most of them are pleased with it.
And from the time it went from this particular production, it came from Kennedy Center to here, to New York, changes were made.
Yeah, well, some changes were made because actors, for example, Linda Lavin, who was in the show in Washington, took another job, And so there were some small changes, some other small changes in the cast. But it was like any show that goes out of town, you tune it up while it's out of town. That was the whole idea in the old days when you took a show to Boston and Philadelphia and Washington and New Haven, was to, first of all, if it was a new show, to fix whatever seemed to be wrong or weak in the writing. And once the writing seemed satisfactory, to tune it up in terms of performance, et cetera, et cetera. So those changes indeed occurred between Washington and New York, and the whole show got tighter and more focused, and some scenery things which got in the way in Washington were changed. Sometimes a very small problem with scenery or costume can affect a whole show.
The two books obviously took a lot of time, and you've been working very hard on them. Does it take you away from the piano? Does it take you away from writing?
Oh, sure. I can only do one thing at a time, and no. My concentration for the last few years has been entirely on these two books.
So do you look, then the obligatory question, of course, is then, do you look forward to that point of getting back?
Yes, I do. I do with some trepidation because I feel rusty now. I haven't been writing songs for a few years, so I'm more than a little nervous about it, but I look forward to it, yeah.
But the nerves, I would think, are part of the juice that get you to do it, aren't they?
Well, it's a different kind. It's a different kind. It's when you haven't ridden a bike for 30 years and you get on the bike, it's nervous making. It's not the usual kind of nervous. It's, can I do it again? And so there's that aspect, which is not something that occurs to you when you're writing continually. Because, you know, up until the book, every year I was writing songs for something. So the muscles were in tune and in shape and all that sort of thing. But, as the old phrase goes, use it or lose it.
I've heard you say that you always have something in the drawer, but your drawer is rather shallow.
No, I'm not sure that I ever said that. Ever said that, because I don't. I never did. I rarely had anything in the future when I was writing anything. It was one show at a time. There are people who have, particularly playwrights, who have ideas that they shove in a drawer so that when they finish one project, they can slip easily and quickly into another. But that's not, and never has been, true of me.
When you look at the show, and going back to the discussion of going in and checking in on Follies and while it's up and running, is there any point that you have to step away?
No. It's first of all, I generally go in like every second week, although I haven't seen Follies now in more than 3 weeks. But that's partly because of doing book promotion and I've been out of town. So you step away perforce. Even the director, if the director lives in the city and checks his show, it's usually once a week at the most. So you get to step away 6 days.
And then in that time, you can write, you can work, and when you're obviously not doing the book stuff, and work on other things.
Mm-hmm.
That show that is up is not at the...
Oh, no, that doesn't interfere with anything now.
Do you find that of there being a progression in the sense of that the work on a show will inform another? In other words, when you look at your lyrics and this book, 1981 to 2011, can you look and pinpoint and see a reflection as to what was happening in your life and what was happening in the world?
No. No. Every set of lyrics is for one particular story and one particular show and doesn't reflect anything else in the outside world except that story. I mean, if there is anything from the outside world or from my inner life that creeps into a lyric, it's unconscious. It's unknown to me.
I guess even as meaning of something that you were working on when an event happened in the world. Do you look at it as,
as
a benchmark?
I can't remember what I was working on when the Kennedy assassination took place. I'm trying to remember what I would be working on in that year. But I guess I was probably working on Anyone Can Whistle.
Anyone can whistle, that's what they say, easy. Anyone can whistle any old day, easy.
it's all so simple. Relax, let go, let fly. So someone tell me why can't I can dance a tango, I can read Greek easy. I can slay a dragon any old week easy. What's hard is simple, what's natural comes hard. Maybe you could show me how to let go.
At least, as I say, nothing conscious.
It would seem to me that would be the way you would want it, that your mind is free to focus on the work at hand.
Yeah, but I think that happens with every writer. You go into a, you know, that's what Finishing the Hat is about. Finishing the Hat is about precisely what you're talking about. I'm not talking about the book, I'm talking about the song,
right.
Finishing the Hat, which the Surratt character sings about how his entire life, anything else in his life, except the concentration on finishing that hat, goes away.
Finishing the hat. How you have to finish the hat. How you watch the rest of the world from a window while you finish the hat. Mapping out a sky. What you feel like planning a sky. What you feel when voices that come through the window till they distance and die, until there's nothing but sky, and how you're always turning back too late from the grass or the stick or the dog or the light, how the kind of woman willing to wait's not the kind that you want to find waiting to return you to the night.
There is nothing else going on in or in him except the concentration on finishing this particular part of this particular painting, and that includes his love life, which, is the conflict in the song and in the first act of the show.
In looking at your work in bound volumes, can you appreciate it in a different way and look at it and say, damn, that's really good?
Yeah, sometimes I was surprised as I wrote and dredged up old lyrics, particularly when I was looking at early drafts or alternate drafts, and then I put everything down on paper. More often than not, I was pleased with what I'd written. I expected less because I'm very self-critical. But no, I liked a lot of the stuff more than I had expected to.
Well, the two books are, the brand new book is Look, I Made a Hat, and that is the follow-up to Finishing the Hat. They are both published by Knopf. And, of course, Follies is on Broadway at the Marquee Theater, and the soundtrack is just out. Stephen Sondheim, a great pleasure to speak with you. I thank you very much for sharing with us this morning.
Thank you, Joe.
Again, Look, I Made a Hat is the new book, Collected Lyrics, 1981 to 2011, with attendant comments, amplifications, dogmas, harangues, digressions, anecdotes, and miscellany. The book is published by Knopf.
When the winds are blowing,
yes,
that's the time to smile.
Oh,
learn how to laugh, learn how to love, learn how to live. That's my style. When the rent is owing,
yes,
what's the use of tears?
Oh,
I'd rather laugh, I'd rather love, I'd rather live. In arrears, some fellows sweat to get to be millionaires. Some have a sport their devil takes. Some like to be the champs at saving postage stamps. Me, I like to live. Me, I like to laugh. Me, I like to love.
You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.